You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Considering just how remarkable it is, it's hard to believe that the story of an African-American soldier who became one of the top military fugitives of World War II has been largely forgotten. While Herman Perry was stationed in Burma, he killed one of his commanders and then disappeared into the jungle and married a local tribal princess. When Brendan Kerner stumbled upon the details of Perry's story, he took a sabbatical from his work at Wired, the New York Times, and Slate to write a book about it, and he's called it How the Hell Will Start, One Soldier's Flight from the Greatest Manhunt of World War II. It's published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Kerner to the show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how did you hear about the story in the first place?
I can actually pinpoint the exact moment. It was September 24th, 2003, and I was actually working on a piece for Slate. At the time, there had been an Air Force officer who'd been arrested for spying for Syria. And a lot of the news reports said he could be put to death if found guilty. And so my editor and I wondered when the last time the U.S. Army had put to death, or the U.S. military had put to death one of its own. And so my day's assignment was to research the history of the military death penalty. And I knew about one case. I knew about Eddie Slovak in World War II. Martin Sheen played him in a movie of the week in the 70s. So I was researching his case kind of as an entree to the whole history. And I came upon a bibliography from an Army archives in Pennsylvania. And it's 12 pages long and all these citations about the War of 1812 and the Civil War. And all of a sudden, there was a little note in the margin, just a couple words, fragmentary. It said, Herman Perry, murderer who long evaded capture by hiding with Burmese hill tribe. And that was all. That was all I had to go on. And I remember reading that and just being struck about the kind of Mr. Kurtz Apocalypse Now flavor to it all. And I wrote down in my Palm Pilot at the time, Herman Perry, ?
Where was he from?
Originally from, born in Monroe, North Carolina, and was part of the Great Migration up north in the 30s to Washington, D.C., leaving behind the rural life. And he became a meat cutter in Washington, D.C., and actually the older brother of a very famous boxer named Aaron the Anvil Perry, who actually fought Henry Armstrong in the 40s and was beaten by him quite badly. So he was really a district guy at heart.
When you started researching the story, did you discover that there was a lot out there?
More than I would have anticipated. I started off by asking for the documents from his court-martial, from the Army, and I was surprised by how much was in their archives.
But you had to go to the Freedom of Information Act to get it,
didn't you? I did.
Is this still something the government considers secret?
No, it's not. A lot of the papers I got had been marked confidential or secret, but they were declassified. They just hadn't been accessed by anybody in decades, really. So there was that. There was also a self-published booklet by a man named Earl Cullum, a man from Texas who was involved in this manhunt. He was a military policeman, later an FBI agent. And he called this the highlight of his career, really one of the highlights of his life, really. And so he chronicled this just for his own edification. And he wrote about a 38-page stapled-together booklet just for his grandchildren, really, so they would know about the case.
This is not one of the most glorious moments in the history of the U.S. military.
No, it's not. I think one of the biggest reasons is because it was the Jim Crow Army, and that's a big explanation for this. When I started looking at the story, I didn't know that Perry was a black soldier, and I didn't know about the segregation in this theater of the war, in India and Burma, where they're building this road across Burma to China to keep our Chinese allies supplied. You basically had these black battalions, all black enlisted men, working as manual laborers, commanded by white officers. And that led to a lot of animosity, a lot of tension between the officers and the GIs.
But hadn't Herman Perry resisted enlisting?
Yes, he had. It's unclear what exactly happened, but he had been imprisoned briefly in 1942 for skipping his army physical. It's not exactly clear whether he just forgot, whether he didn't want to go into the army, whatever it is. I interviewed his sister, and his sister claims that he was actually very excited to be in the army and to go on the adventure overseas, but that part is a little bit of a mystery as to why he missed that physical.
Well, there were any number of African Americans who felt that this was, even though it might have been a just cause, Paul Robeson was one. He said this was people of color fighting against people of color. Mm-hmm. For a white nation.
Yeah, Absolutely. There was a big intellectual movement at the time among a lot of preachers in particular who advised their congregations and people who would listen to avoid the draft, to not fight. And one of the reasons that black soldiers did end up, you know, fighting en masse is because of the black press formed what was called the Double V campaign. They initially resisted these calls for enlistment. And they kind of became convinced that, well, if we prove our bravery and mettle on the battlefields abroad, when we come back, we'll have a justification to ask for civil rights.
Although in many cases, black soldiers were denied even the opportunity to fight. They wound up with the lousy jobs, and this was an example of that.
That's exactly right. The vast majority of black soldiers in World War II were consigned to jobs behind the front lines, not combat, but washing dishes, digging trenches, and in Herman Perry's case, building this road through the jungles of Burma.
But even before, the conditions on the USS West Point, the boat that the company arrived on, seemed pretty awful.
Yeah, the USS West Point was actually a converted luxury liner. It was supposed to be, it was called the SS America originally. It was supposed to be our version of the Queen Mary. And they made it into this troop transport, and they would put all the white officers, you know, in what used to be the luxury suites, and they put the black soldiers down below the hull next to the boiler room on these really, really decrepit circumstances. And that contributed, I think, in some part to the fraying of Perry's psyche.
Were there any black officers?
Not in this theater of the war. There were a few throughout. There was famously a General Davis, but really all these battalions in India and Burma, all white officers, all black GIs.
And you say that they were all building this road on the China-Burma-India front, called the CBI.
Yep.
That also earned a second meaning among the soldiers.
Yeah, they called it a confusion beyond imagination. It was this complete backwater. All the resources in the U.S. were, of course, focused on Berlin and Tokyo. And here you have, we're trying to support Chiang Kai-shek, China's dictator, and we're going through the jungles of Burma. And people back in the States didn't pay attention, and that includes our politicians in the War Department. So it was really an undersupplied theater of the war.
And the conditions were awful.
Truly horrific. The jungle, I think, is a big character in my book.
Did you go there?
I did.
Does the road still exist?
The road still exists, and I talk about in the book in the beginning my walking, literally walking, because you couldn't drive from India over the Indo-Burmese border and descending towards a lake of no return in Burma. Most of it's a bog. It really is just mud up to your ankles, even higher.
Isn't part an ironic part of the story that even though this is being done for Chiang Kai-shek, at a certain point, military leaders realized that China didn't really care about this project?
That part fascinated me, that there was evidence in the literature from these meetings, high-level meetings they had in Washington at the War Department, at the White House, basically acknowledging that they'd poured all these hundreds of millions of dollars into this project, and ultimately China wasn't doing anything for us.
When did Perry start getting into trouble with his commanders?
It was really October 43. He talked back to a lieutenant, Lieutenant Stergos, and he was sentenced to 3 months hard labor in the Lido stockade. And that's where he truly began to unravel, in part because of the punishments he was subjected to, one of which was called the box, which was this 2-foot by 5-foot concrete windowless box, literally, that they would put these misbehaving prisoners in. They couldn't stand up all the way, leave them in there for days, and they would come out and be debilitated and have a lot of mental problems as a result of their isolation. And he was put in there several times because of his misbehavior.
And wound up killing his commander.
When he gets out of the Lido stockade, he has a real axe to grind with the army, and he also begins abusing drugs quite heavily, particularly opium. He goes out on an all-night bender the night of March 4th, 1944, comes back to his camp, sleeps through the wake-up call, and they tell him he's going to be arrested, and he flips out. He starts crying and bawling. He has his rifle with him. He's walking down the road, and this unarmed lieutenant comes up on him and ends up being shot to death twice with his rifle.
Did they arrest him?
No, he immediately ran off into the jungle and was really not seen again for many, many months.
And he managed to ally himself with the local tribe called the Nagas. Mm-hmm. Had he met them before?
Yes, he had. The Nagas were a mystery to the GIs, but also a presence every day along the road. They lived very high up in the jungle. They were notorious headhunters, so the GIs knew better than to mess with them. They would come down and sell knives and marijuana and chickens to the GIs. Then they would kind of disappear back into the jungle. People called them like ghosts, really. And so he knew of them. He'd encountered them, but they weren't friends.
Well, it's one thing to kind of get along with them. It's another thing to marry a tribal princess. How did he manage that?
Yeah, that to me is really the heart and soul of the story. He'd been on the run for a few weeks in March of 44, and he just came to this village called Tugumga, which also called Glau. He called it Glau. He couldn't quite pronounce Tugumga. And he basically bribed them, is the first thing he did. He had encountered some British patrol officers in the jungle, civil affairs patrols, administering the empire, and they'd given him rations. And he gave these to the Naga. And these were very highly prized by the Naga, not so much for the food, but for the tin. Tin was not part of their metallurgy at that point.
So he gave them tins of fruit cocktail. They threw out the fruit cocktail, said, "Ooh, this is too sweet," and then...
Yeah,
use the tin for jewelry.
And then he got more. He actually went down to the road, risked arrest, and he found sympathetic GIs who got him more and more supplies. So that was a great in for him at the very beginning.
But eventually he was betrayed by the Naga tribesmen, despite the fact that he had married the princess and she was bearing his child?
He was, I wouldn't say necessarily betrayed. What happened is that he was sending down his Naga cousins at that point. He'd married to this young girl.
14 years old.
14 years old. Sending them down to Namyong, the Namyong rice station, to get supplies for him. And someone blabbed. Someone blabbed about, "Hey, my cousin married this black American soldier," and word got around. And certainly the U.S. Army did have Naga allies whom they bribed with opium to help them on the mission with the posse to recover Private Perry.
Now, why would he have even been allowed to marry a woman of such import?
It wasn't the first time that Nagas had offered a woman to an outsider. I actually found a case of an American doctor who had restored the sight of a Naga chieftain, and he offered him his daughter's hand in marriage, which this doctor declined. This was, of course, the first time that an American had taken them up on the offer.
Well, the story sounds almost like part myth. Has anyone ever met this princess?
No one's met the princess. I did interview a man who had met her in 1945, a man named Richard Johnston, who now lives in Texas, and had been in the village in August of 1945, Tugumga, also known as Glau, and met not only the Perry's wife, but also his infant son at that time, who was about 6 months old when he met him.
So Perry was captured, and then he escaped again.
Yes, he did. He was captured, court-martialed, sentenced to death. And then while he was on death row in India, waiting for his appeals to be heard, and there was a great bureaucracy and some holdups, which I describe in the book, he actually managed to break out of the Lido stockade and ran back into the jungle.
And then they caught him again, after this huge manhunt.
They did catch him again. The manhunt really stepped up in that second phase between, say, Christmas time of 1944 and when they eventually captured him in March of 45. And this was led by this Colonel Cullum I referred to before, who wrote this pamphlet for his children.
On the day of his execution, Perry said, "Now the hell will start," which is what you have adapted for your title. Why did he say that?
I think he meant it literally. It was really his last words when he was being handed over from his guard, Colonel Cullum, over to the executioner. He turns to Colonel Cullum and says, "Now the hell will start." I think he meant it literally, but I saw it as accidental poetry. I saw it having great significance for describing his almost descent from being a happy-go-lucky kind of Romeo figure in Washington, D.C., and descending into this hell of the jungle, and this hell of segregation, and this hell of his own opium addiction.
Did many people die as a result of the building of the road?
Yeah, they called it the Man-a-Mile Road, but I found out that the more accurate term would have been the Two-Man-a-Mile Road, and that's only American casualties. There are many, many of these native laborers known as coolies in the un-PC lingo of the day. No one knows how many of them died. In fact, I found a graveyard out there near the border where who knows how many of these coolies were put laid to rest.
Did you contact any members of Perry's family?
I did. I tracked down his sister, his lone surviving sibling, who lives in Washington, D.C., and I actually helped her fulfill one of her great wishes, and that is having her brother's remains brought back to Washington, D.C.
One of his sister, Edna Wilson, was the subject of a recent article in the Washington Post.
Yeah, that's right. Will Haygood, one of the Post's great writers, was very interested in the book. And I went down there to meet with him, and he met with Miss Wilson as well and wrote about her story and getting the body back to D.C.
Would you describe your portrayal of Herman Perry as sympathetic, even though he committed a murder?
That's an excellent question. He's a very ambiguous character, obviously. He's a person who he suffered an emotional collapse under circumstances that were obviously unimaginably difficult for most people. At the same time, he shot an unarmed man to death. And I think balancing those two aspects of who he was and what he did and what was done to him was the real challenge of writing the book.
You write that you hope the story will serve as a meditation on the consequences of irrationality. What do you mean by that?
I think time and again in the book, not just in Perry's case, but in building the road, in kind of sending all these young men out to die in Burma and China for reasons no one could quite pin down, were things that people had stopped and thought about what was going on and what they were doing and the real rationale for why they were doing it. These people didn't have to die. These great mistakes didn't have to be made.
And this sort of thing, we hope, stopped happening after the Army was integrated at the order of Harry Truman in 1948.
You would hope so, but I've certainly heard from quite a few black veterans of Korea and Vietnam who read the book and felt it really spoke to their experience in those later wars as well.
Brendan I. Kerner's book, Now the Hell Will Start, One Soldier's Flight from the Greatest Manhunt of World War II, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a million.